Thank you. Be seated. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Ritchie versus Brookshire Grocery.
May I please support Mr. Gregory Greycheck, which is an argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 6 minutes of audience.
May it please the court. I'm here today with Kelly Ritchie, petitioner before the court, and Bill Lee, trial counsel, attempting to set aside the erroneous decision of a majority of the Tyler Court of Appeals in this malicious prosecution case. In the early morning hours of December 11, 1989, Kelly Ritchie entered the Brookshire's grocery store in Tyler, Texas, to pick up a few grocery items for his family, and ended up in what to him has turned out to be a living nightmare. The issue in this case turns, as in most malicious prosecution cases, on that of evidence or surrounding the element of probable cause, or the lack of probable cause. As this court has recently noted, conflicting policies define the cause of action for malicious prosecution. On the one hand, persons wrongly accused of crimes should not be without a remedy. On the other hand, the prospect that the remedy must not be so formidable as to discourage criminal complaints or reporting of crimes is likewise important. This court, when considering the standard on which to judge or make a determination of the existence of probable cause, long ago adopted what it called among the very best definitions given of probable cause from the United States Supreme Court decision in Wheeler v. Nesbitt, that being the existence of such facts and circumstances as would excite belief in a reasonable mind acting on the facts within the knowledge of the prosecutor that the person charged was guilty of the crime committed or being prosecuted. This court has consistently confirmed that this is an objective standard.
Well, using that framework and looking at it objectively, why is it that your client himself has not established the objective standard of probable cause by admitting that he walked out of the store with the cigarettes without paying for it, and that it would have been obvious to someone else observing it? In fact, he did appropriate the cigarettes improperly.
That is the very issue that the Tyler Court of Appeals hung its hat on, and which clearly is not the standard. But the fact that he admitted, and the admission, I think it's important if you look at the record, he prefaced his statement that he did not intend to steal the package of cigarettes, which is what we're talking about. What he did was inadvertently left the store with a package of cigarettes he hadn't paid for. That does not admit nor establish a crime. Just as this court discussed in Esquivel versus Watson, the petitioner admitted that she wrote a check without sufficient funds in her account. But the court pointed out that Esquivel's admission that she knew when she wrote a check in question that she did not have sufficient funds to cover it does not amount to the admission that she committed a criminal offense.
He's not talking about admission of a crime, though. The question was probable cause to excite a reasonable mind to believe, et cetera.
That's right. The evidence needs to be such that would cause a reasonable person to believe. I believe the question was concerning why doesn't the admission alone establish that probable cause.
No, it's not the admission alone, but your client himself has established that a reasonable person would have believed that he was, in fact, stealing cigarettes from the store.
No, I understand it, that he did say, as a layman, that somebody seeing what was going on may have assumed that he did steal the cigarettes because he left without paying for them. But what I'm saying is probable cause to commit theft requires more than that.
And you're saying it requires intent.
It requires the element of intent.
And how are they to determine intent without inquiring specifically of the person accused of the crime?
There are lots of factors that weigh on the element of intent other than asking the person. It's not solely a subjective, did you intend to steal? No, I didn't, and that's it. Just like the Court of Appeals error in deciding, well, we're just going to look at what the manager thought and believe what he thought, and that decides the issue for us. It's all an objective standard. You look at the facts and circumstances. In this case, we've got a man enters the grocery store, picks up cigarettes, Pampers, baby food, Eggos, $50-some worth of groceries, goes to the checkout stand, pays at the checkout stand with a personal check. I mean, on the way out of the store, he identifies himself to the grocery store. Not only does he positively identify himself, they've got his phone number, they've got his address, and as all retailers can tell you, the check tells you significant information about the person.
Why is it not adequate, being that he did walk out of the store with the cigarettes, to go ahead and report it to the authorities and let them go through their investigative process? And if, after learning all of the facts that you use in support of your claim, the DA's office can then decide, well, there's no probable cause to go ahead and indict this guy or assert a criminal action against him. In other words, why not leave it up to the legal authority to undertake that investigation?
That, of course, is always an option when you are aware of information that you believe may or may not point to a crime, is to fairly, accurately, and fully disclose that information to the prosecutor and let them carry forward at that point.
Did Mr. Good hold back when he spoke with the authorities? Did he hold back the information that he went to the line, purchased $50 worth of groceries, and left baby food in the charity bin?
I believe the record does disclose, yes, he did hold back certain information, both
Mr.
that
Mr. Good held that back when he talked to the authorities about the issue? Mr. Ritchie?
Mr. Ritchie, the petitioner, explained what he was allowed to explain. Neither the police officer who came to issue the citation nor the store personnel would talk to him. After the complaint is filed, I mean, Brookshire's made the decision, they're going forward, they're prosecuting this claim. The prosecutor has no choice at that point. I guess there is some prosecutorial discretion at that point, but in essence, and that's why it's never been an issue in this case, is Brookshire decided to prosecute, they insisted on prosecuting, they went forward with the prosecution. The fact that you have to do it through the system and the prosecutor at some point to say, well, I'm just not going to mess with this, that does alone excuse the conduct in getting to that point in the first place. It's especially in the misdemeanor courts, it's clear that once a person makes a formal complaint, signs the affidavit, and files it, the prosecutor really is almost duty-bound to go forward, and unless they have proof positive that there's some lies or something. This particular complaint that was filed by Brookshire omits a lot of information, both what they contend supports probable cause and what we contend rejects probable cause. But
how does omitting information that supports probable cause help your case?
We contend that was information the jury was free to and should have inferred lack of probable cause, because they could have, and rightfully should have, I think in this case, decided that Russell Ferris, knowing that he did wrong, tried to make up a story to sell the probable cause issue. Russell Ferris, after going through a full trial in the criminal court, after disclosing to his company, after disclosing to the prosecutor, after disclosing to the police officer what he contended were the facts of this case, steps up on the witness stand on rebuttal and says, oh, well, I suddenly remember he had some shifty looks, he had some nervous twitches, he had this glazed look in his eye, and I was afraid of him because of the smell of alcohol. This was all enhancement-type evidence that the jury knew was never reported before until 3 years after the fact. All of a sudden, after he's testified once, steps back on the stand and suddenly remembers all of this negative information that he classifies as significant in making the judgment that a crime had been committed. The jury should have and could have inferred from the fact that he suddenly remembered this information that he was trying to bolster a less than credible story. And that's Justice Holcomb in the Court of Appeals, I think, wrote eloquently on what those statements were in the jury proper.
So your position then is if he leaves out information that is exculpatory, that tends to show no probable cause. If he leaves out information that's not exculpatory, that tends to show no probable cause. So if he doesn't get it exactly right,
no,
he's in a pickle.
That's not exactly what I'm contending. Clearly, he leaves out information as exculpatory. This court and all the courts have held that the prosecutor no longer has the ability to make an informed decision because he doesn't have the information. What I'm saying is, in this particular record, the fact that he left out what he considered to be significant information that he says led him to believe a crime was committed until 3 years later was information that the jury could have, in their judging the credibility of witnesses and weighing the evidence, inferred that he was making up a story to bolster something he knew was wrong.
But it doesn't tend to show that he did or didn't have probable cause at the time.
I think
unless you believe him. And
I think that information, as well as the facts in the case in general, raise sufficient prima facie evidence of improper motive to rebut the presumption that he enjoys that he was in good faith. Once that happens, as this court has held, it then becomes an issue of fact for a jury to determine. They then look at all the facts and circumstances, weigh the evidence and credibility of the witnesses, and determine who or who was not correct in their decision.
Do you think the manager had probable cause to stop him as he left the store?
Certainly.
And detain him?
Stop and inquire, and that would entitle some detainment, yes.
And then after that, when do you think there was no longer any probable cause to do it? As soon as he said it was a mistake?
I would contend, yes, that based on the facts that were in his possession. Now, if the manager had stopped him and said, wait a minute, you didn't pay for the cigarettes, he said, oh, I made a mistake, I forgot about it. He said, well, come back in the store. If the manager had then gone to the cash register and checked his identification information on the check, said, yeah, I mean, this guy is clearly not some deadbeat off the street. I think that would have been sufficient investigation for him to have confirmed that this was not a case of theft. All the circumstances surrounding this issue, and it's to me, it's so compelling that the jury is so motivated to find against this man and award four times the damages that the plaintiff even asked for in this case, still had the presence of mind to make the distinction and say, well, surely they had a right to stop him. There was no false imprisonment here because he did leave the store without paying for the cigarettes. But based on all the facts and circumstances surrounding what the manager knew at the time, because he went into this thing looking to find something, he did find something. He looked at all the evidence wrong because his motive from the very beginning was wrong.
Is it your position that Brookshire should not be liable in this case had they been more forthcoming to the authorities with regard to all the information, such as the $50 or $60 purchase of the baby food put in the charity bin, the offer to pay, things like that? Had Brookshire been fully forthcoming in detail about everything that happened, would you be of the position that they should be not held liable in this case?
No. No, because of all the circumstances surrounding this case, the facts showed a reasonable person in the manager's position that there was no crime being committed. If Brookshire had disclosed all of this information to the authorities and did not swear out a complaint, then the situation may be different. But they took the formal action of prosecuting by swearing out a complaint, filing the affidavit, and pursuing the claim through the criminal court system.
What if a woman goes to the Neiman Marcus, she has an account there, and she buys a few items, but she slips a scarf into her purse, and she pays for some items with her credit card, walks out to the valet parking, and the store manager follows her out there and asks her for an explanation. She fully intended to steal the scarf, but being caught, she says, oh, I'm sorry, it was a mistake. Is he supposed to believe that simply because she's affluent and has a credit card and account with the store?
No, certainly not. And I'm not trying to contend that just because you can afford to pay for the stuff you steal, that you should get away with stealing.
They know who she is. She's had a credit card account.
What I'm saying is,
the difference in that case and your case?
What I'm saying is all the circumstances must be looked at. It is practically improbable that a thief is going to walk into a store, steal something on his way out, positively identify himself to the store manager.
What's the difference in the woman who shops at Neiman Marcus but isn't kleptomaniac, steals, and she does it regularly, but denies that she did it? How is the Neiman Marcus supposed to know what her intent was?
Again, by weighing the circumstances that exist. I mean, there are certain things that will lead you to believe theft has occurred, certain things that don't, and then a gray area. What you're talking about is a woman walks into a store, looks around, sticks. You know, that motion alone is indication that she intends to steal. That motion alone gives the manager information that he says she's not doing what she's supposed to be doing. But if you got a man twiddling a pack of cigarettes, walking down, picking up grocery items, and inadvertently sticks them in his pocket, because that's what smokers do out of habit, and the stores know this, that's why most stores put the cigarette packs at the register so you can pick them up so they don't fall out, you don't have them in your hands, you're not walking around with them. The circumstances must be looked at from a reasonable man standard. That's why the reasonable man standard exists. In this particular instance, Russell Ferris jumped immediately to the conclusion, aha, I think I'm going to find something here. And without any suspicion, after the man walked into the store, began following him, stalking him through the store. Now, the fact that this particular person inadvertently put cigarettes in his pocket does not excuse his improper motivation from the very beginning. And it's because of that that every decision he made after that was tainted. He looked at it from the presumption that he had a thief, and therefore he presumed that everything he saw was suspicious.
Any other questions? Thank you, Tim. The court is ready to hear argument from response.
May I please the court? Mr. Michael Hatchell will present argument from the respondent.
May I please the court? I think it's very important to understand how this case was submitted. Pardon me, Your Honor. Here we go. This case was submitted to the jury, and Mr. Ritchie is attempting to sustain a verdict submitted on an entirely objective standard for want of probable cause. That standard was accurately stated to the court by opposing counsel as being the existence of such facts and circumstances as would cause the belief in a reasonable man acting on the facts within the knowledge of the complainant that the person charged was guilty of the crime for which he was prosecuted. And the reason I think that this is very important is because much of the argument that I hear today has to do, number one, with Mr. Ferris's, Brookshire's employee, subjective determination or his negligence in not investigating as fully as opposing counsel says he should have. And so I have two difficulties from a legal standpoint with that. Number one, subjective or honesty in fact, objective standard, was not submitted in this case and is not part of the jury verdict. And number two, it is not a tort to negligently investigate a suspected shoplifter. We have based our argument in this case only on facts that are undisputed in the genuine sense of the word. That Mr. Ritchie came into our store. He took a pack of cigarettes and initially put it in his basket where it was in view. That later, he, quote, according to his own description, concealed the cigarettes. That he passed through the checkout line with the opportunity to pay for them. That he did not pay for them. That he exited the store with them. And when he was confronted in the parking lot asking whether or not he had not paid for any merchandise, he denied it. Now
to complete the picture, there are other facts that are undisputed.
Yes.
He paid over $51 of groceries?
That's correct.
You do not dispute that?
No, that's his receipt is in evidence.
And that he went back and paid an additional $9 worth of groceries that he put in the charity bin.
That's correct.
So that's the complete picture.
That's correct. Those two facts, Your Honor, the fact that someone pays for goods seems to me to be almost the prototypical person who is shoplifting in a grocery store. Because very few people, I think, who with intent to shoplift are going to go into the grocery store and then simply walk out. that brings too much suspicion on themselves, and I think the evidence in this case is that Brookshire's could only remember one instance where somebody stole a pack of cigarettes without going through the checkout line. Number two, putting baby food in the charity bin the second time he walked through. Your Honor must understand that when he checked out the first time, and Brookshire employees were close to him, he suddenly turns around, goes back into the store, buys the baby food, and puts it in. This is a fact that cuts to Brookshire both ways. It looks pretextual, and the reason it looks pretextual is what is the very first thing that Mr. Ritchie says when the police arrive? I want you to put in your report that I put baby food in the charity bin. And what's the first thing he does when he knows he's going to be given a citation? He walks over and he takes it out.
If it were pretextual, wouldn't it have been more economical for him, instead of going back and buying the baby food, just going back and paying for the cigarettes?
There's no question that that's true. But I don't know that once one has facts before them which are reasonably indicative of the crime, that a fine analysis of the rationality of an attempt to cover up that is really an appropriate inquiry for the citizen prosecutor.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume that a person in a wheelchair goes into Brookshire's, does some shopping, buys a couple of large items, a loaf of bread, a gallon of milk, and one real small item. And because that person has to use both hands to push him or herself around the store, they slip the small item in their pocket, fully intending on paying for it, go through the checkout stand, pay for the bread and milk, forget about the small item in their pocket, go out the door, and are met by the Brookshire manager. And despite the fact that the person in the wheelchair had no intent whatsoever to steal the item and had every intent to pay for it and had it in his or her pocket solely because they couldn't carry it otherwise, that person at Brookshire's would have had a complaint filed against him and would have had to go through the criminal process. Tell me why that's not true.
Well, it is not true because the evidence in this case shows that the manager do have some discretion. But I think in some instances, yes, Your Honor, it could be true if from the standpoint of the person observing the activity that he could conclude reasonably that a crime had been committed on the basis of the facts and circumstances. Facts and circumstances, Your Honor, in my judgment, do not include the concept of subjective intent.
So the only material facts are that the customer leaves the store with something they haven't paid for. And there can never be a malicious prosecution judgment rendered against the store under those circumstances. Is that what you're saying?
I think I'm very close to saying.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
And so there is no distinction in your mind or in your client's mind between whether the customer is actually guilty of a crime or guilty in sort of the civil sense of converting property that isn't theirs, that is taking something without paying for it.
Well, to say there is no distinction, let me try to answer it without directly answering the question. I think that the difficult thing in malicious prosecution cases where the want of probable cause focuses upon the supposed intent of the party accused is the juxtaposition between the difficulty of someone ascertaining subjective intent and being able to determine intent inferably from the conduct itself. The citizen prosecutor is in a real jam in this case. And in this case, Your Honor, and perhaps also Judge Abbott, insofar as your question is concerned, we do have Mr. Ritchie's own assessment what his conduct looked like that night. He called his conduct a stupid mistake, and I'm not sure I would call Your Honor's conduct a stupid mistake, but he said, and the reason why it was a mistake is because somebody could look at that and think you were in fact shoplifting based on what they observed about your conduct. That's right. Now here I am, the citizen prosecutor, looking at this conduct even through the eyes of the person accused, and then being told that you don't have probable cause. And what happened even when we get to the stage of the prosecution? In a practical sense, talking to Mr. Ritchie, you could have been found guilty of the charge. Yes, that's possible. Here again is his own assessment that the objective view of his conduct imported intent. Now, so here's the dilemma. If you're requiring me, when faced with that sort of conduct, to conduct an investigation to determine intent, then that seems to me like you're moving malicious prosecution into the area of failure to investigate. And the cases have said that's not the essence of malicious prosecution. The second thing that the cases have said is that it is not the citizen prosecutor's duty to determine excuses such as alibis, lack of intent.
On the other hand, if the store prosecutes everyone without distinction between criminal takings and inadvertent takings, that is malicious prosecution, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, well, and why inadvertent? I mean, you mean if they do it indiscriminately without thinking?
If they do it indiscriminately, if they prosecute as a matter of course against every customer who takes a pack of chewing gum and forgets to pay for it at the witness stand, that is makes no distinction between intent to steal it and inadvertence in taking. That is malicious prosecution.
I don't think so, Your Honor. Again, it seems to me what you're saying is you're guilty because you failed to investigate. You care not at all. Now that may well be an element of the malice.
Actually, what I was driving at, and maybe I'm not clear, is the policy of prosecuting as a matter of course without making that distinction, that is malicious prosecution,
no,
isn't it?
Okay. No, it's not. As long as each individual, see, again, moving back to a subjective test, it seems
well,
to me,
it's,
what was
it's
charged?
Inherently, you have, since the intent, the criminal law makes the distinction between inadvertent and intentional takings, isn't that inherently part of the picture? Even though there is an objective test that the, for malicious prosecution with which the jury is charged, which I think you cited earlier. So why isn't the taker's intent always a question here for the jury?
Oh, it is relevant. It is relevant in the prosecution itself. And my argument is based upon the fact that there are pre-existing facts from facts and circumstances in obviated conduct that would import the requisite intent. Because it seems to me, Your Honor, that if what you're saying is we must go forward and investigate one's intent, aren't they always going to deny it? And indeed, isn't the giving of a not guilty plea in court, and you're continuing the prosecution under that aspect of the restatement that says you can be guilty of malicious prosecution for continuing, isn't the not guilty plea itself then some evidence that should have caused me to discontinue the prosecution? That's the problem that I see here. Once I am presented with the objective facts that to a reasonably prudent person would imply intent, and indeed in this case, according to the assessment of Ritchie, Mr. Ritchie himself implied intent.
Help me understand or evaluate two critical factors with regards to the objective standard. First of all, in the shoplifting case, the tribunal acquitted Mr. Richardson, not guilty of shoplifting. And a jury heard these arguments you're making here, I take it, based on your arguments that there is probable cause, and the jury was outraged at Brookshire's conduct and said, not only was there no probable cause, Brookshire, we're going to punish you punitive damages in equal amount. So we've had a fair and impartial tribunal, two tribunals, who have listened to these arguments and said, Brookshire, your conduct was reprehensible. Enough for us to punish you. How should I weigh all these things if we're looking at the jury verdict and we make all the presumptions and look to see whether or not there's some evidence to support the jury verdict?
You can answer Your Honor's question in two ways. It seems to me that the factors that you have focused on are obviously factors which occurred after the events in question. The existence of probable cause or not probably occurred in the parking lot on December 11th when this incident occurred. And I think it was the Chief Justice's decision, I hope it's the Leak case, it's Aiken versus Dawes, in which there was emphasis upon what happened in the commitment hearings. And the court said, no, that's not evidence at all. And of course, what happened in the jury trial in this case, I think is cannot be lensed back to December 11th as well.
The jury was given an instruction with regards to the elements,
yes,
of the tort. They had an option to find Brookshire guilty of false imprisonment. They said, no, Brookshire, this is not a false imprisonment, but it is malicious prosecution.
Indeed, Your Honor, that's true. But I think that Mr. Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court of the United States recently has put this very well. Probably the best answer I can give to your question. It's not what Brookshire believes. It's what the court believes. And that's simply saying, as Chief Justice Claude Williams said in the Balance Hunting and Fishing case, that it is almost invariable the existence of proximate cause is a question of law. And that's really the issue. Here, we have based our
argument. You mean probable. Existence probable cause.
Right. Here, we have based our argument entirely on facts that are genuine, undisputed in the evidence. And we are taking the position simply that probable cause was established as a matter of law. And I think that is the way it should be.
Your argument is, in essence, that no reasonable person would fail to believe that Mr. Ritchie was not guilty of the crime with which he was charged. Isn't that correct?
I don't know, Your Honor, if I can say that's putting it, coming at it negatively when you say no reasonable person.
Well,
your
argument is there's no evidence to support the judgment here. So in essence, to agree with you, don't we have to say that no reasonable person would fail to believe that he was not guilty?
No, I don't think so. I think what you have to say that as a matter of law, there were facts in existence which would lead inexorably in a reasonable manner to a conclusion that a party was guilty of a crime for which he would have been charged. Not that no reasonable person would ever come to that conclusion on a case-by-case basis, but given the undisputed facts in this case.
But to go back to what you said earlier, I take it that any time a customer leaves the store without paying for an item, the cause of action for malicious prosecution cannot lie, because there is always probable cause to believe they're guilty of the crime of shoplifting.
I don't know that I can say that every instance that's true. Let me give you just the one example that's in this case. We had a customer who came through the checkout line and left with an item that obviously had all symptoms. And that was assessed, you know, on the scene, and no prosecution was made. So I think that there can be instances where such diminished capacity is evident that, or indeed other circumstances on an exceptional case-by-case basis, but where it would not be true.
But Mr. Hansel, is it correct that Brookshire has a policy that every case of shoplifting is prosecuted?
No.
That's not true.
No, that is not correct.
So the store manager has discretion on a case-by-case basis?
Yes, and I think it says in the written policy itself. The written policy has a three-part, three prongs to it. Did he conceive it, and did he have the opportunity to pay for it? Did he leave the store with it? And then the testimony is that they should conduct a reasonable investigation, and if they are sure, then they can prosecute him. What they
but
are resident.
If they're sure of what? That the three
then,
criteria
right.
exist,
right.
and that's the end of it.
Right.
So from that point on, whatever said or happened has no bearing on whether to file a complaint or not if the manager follows the policy.
Your Honor, I can't say that it has no bearing.
Except, well, is the Alzheimer's case the only one where they didn't prosecute?
No.
More than one.
No. There are instances in the record, although candidly I don't think there's a comprehensive analysis. But again, what we're doing is we're getting back, it seems to me, to the question of negligent investigation and subjective determinations.
And in that regard, did you say this Brookshire's own policy to investigate each matter?
Yes.
And so what you're saying then is that they have imposed upon themselves a duty to investigate.
That's correct. Indeed they have.
With regard to the duty to investigate, should that duty differ depending upon whether or not the store files a formal complaint or doesn't file a formal complaint and just merely informs the authorities?
I think it does, Your Honor. I have very serious questions in the initiation cases whether or not there is any duty on behalf of the prosecutor to make, number one, a fair and full disclosure, and number two, a reasonable investigation, as long as he is acting on objective facts that would establish probable cause. The procurement cases are somewhat more troublesome to me in that regard, but let me say that in answer to where, what I think the gist of your question is that there, insofar as investigations and things like that are concerned, there is a bulwark of protection in the concept of prosecutorial discretion. Not prosecutorial discretion to initiate, but prosecutorial discretion to continue the prosecution, which is codified in the Code of Criminal Procedure and in our ethical considerations. And that's why I think that insofar as the court may have concerns about investigations, that that is the protection of the hands, and that the difficult crime of malicious prosecution has to be tested strictly by the objective facts and circumstances that were apparent and known to the party making the charge.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court. In Aiken versus Dahl, this court found that the presumption that it's been reasonably in good faith disappears when the plaintiff produces evidence that the motives, grounds, beliefs, and other evidence upon which the defendant acted were indeed not probable cause. Once the parties have entered into a factual contest on this issue, a fact issue is created for resolution by the trier of fact. This, the court states, is a cornerstone of our judicial system. I think that aptly states where we're at in this case. Two juries have heard this case. Both of them, without any hesitation, said, no, these circumstances do not create a crime. Clearly, the second jury, incensed by the fact that they do not even create probable cause, elected to punish Brookshire's in an attempt to tell them you cannot treat people this way. I think it's significant that the Brookshire's own policy was not even followed in this case, and there's significant evidence in the record of this. There are not three prongs to Brookshire's policy. There are four. Granted, the majority of the Court of Appeals, as well as Brookshire's, fails to recognize the fourth prong to their own policy. But the written policy states that if you saw them conceal the merchandise, if you have it in your possession, and you have an opportunity to pay for it, but don't. And if after reasonable investigation you believe the person is guilty of shoplifting,
That simply iterates the standard for malicious prosecution. If you believe or excite in your mind, assuming that you're a reasonable person, the firm belief that a crime has been committed, that theft, that is, appropriation with intent to steal, if you believe that has occurred, then you prosecute. Brookshire, by their own admissions throughout the record, by all of their management employees, state they never get to the fourth element. They never consider intent. Their loss prevention manager says, well, that's something we just don't address. As Justice Holcomb pointed out in his dissenting opinion in this case, Russell Ferris, the assistant manager in this case, had stopped, I can't find the number, it's 300 and something, well over 300, almost 400 people were stopped. Not a single person was ever given the consideration that this is not theft. Every single one across the board prosecuted through the court system.
Maybe they were all theft.
We are left to either presume that or to presume that Brookshire's, as their managers seem to indicate, do not consider whether it's theft or not.
But they could have all been theft.
That they could have. We could make that assumption. But I believe, applying the proper no evidence review, we must make the opposite assumption. We must imply or take every inference in favor of the jury's verdict.
How can you infer either way?
We can infer that out of 300 and something stops, no one's ever given a break, and in this case, he's not given a break when the evidence firmly shows they should have. We can infer from that malice. We can infer that he doesn't care whether you're guilty or not. He's simply going to prosecute you if you walk out of the store with some type of merchandise in your pocket.
What fact, Mr. Richard, what fact that Brookshire and their manager relied on for asserting that shoplifting occurred was not true? Is there a fact in this case that the manager said he relied on in asserting that shoplifting occurred that was not true?
I believe there were facts that the jury found were not true, and they're judging the credibility, and those are the facts that I discussed. Is suddenly remembered 3 years later, after on rebuttal, that there were shifty looks.
Talking about the facts that is, I guess I should focus on. If I understand Mr. Hensel's argument, it is that probable cause is a question of law for the court. It seems to me, if that's his argument, there could be facts existing at the time that the manager makes the decision to make it the complaint that might be an issue. It is true or it wasn't true. The manager said it. This is the fact I relied on. I filed, and the other side comes in and says, no, that fact wasn't true. You knew it wasn't true. And therefore, without that fact, there was no probable cause. I'm just asking, is there a fact at the time that the manager made the complaint that the manager says they were relying on that the jury found was not true?
Again, yes. It's suddenly remembered 3 years later are facts that he himself designated as extremely significant in determining that this was a crime of theft rather than an inadvertent action. And I think that it's significant when we start from the very
beginning.
Without
that fact, as a matter of law, there is not probable cause.
And I think that's exactly true. I think if we look at the very beginning of this case, when Kelly Ritchie stepped into that store and Russell Ferris admitted he was the only customer in the store and he began following him immediately. No suspicion, no reason to do anything other than, let's see if we can make something. I think the jury then heard Russell Ferris' interpretation of the facts and found that Russell Ferris was simply not believable. He found it suspicious that somebody would read the back of a cereal box, even though he admitted customers do that all the time. He found it suspicious that somebody would give something to their own charity, and apparently not many people did because the evidence in the box was empty at that night, and that's why it motivated Kelly Ritchie to give something to charity. I think the evidence is clear, and the jury found without any problem that the evidence is clear. There was no probable cause of theft. That jury determination should be upheld.
Thank you. That concludes the argument in the second clause. The court will take another brief recess.
All rise.